Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
This is the place where Black is the main character, where we dive into something new like the latest season of Them, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction. Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love. And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop and BMF. Explore Prime Video's culture-rated collection and enjoy old-school greats and new-school hits. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/Amazon Prime for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily for September 7th, 2017. On today's show, we'll be stopping by the water cooler, talking about It, talking about Boston, talking about My Immortal. What is that? Find out in a few seconds. In the news, we're going to be talking about problematic casting in the live-action Aladdin movie, an authorized Dracula prequel. Justice League is still undergoing reshoots. We'll talk about that. And some unlikely bidders have come into play for the James Bond film rights. And in the mailbag, we'll be talking about Kathleen Kennedy's role in all these Star Wars problems. This is Peter Serretta. And with me on today's show are Ben Pearson.
Hey, what's up?
And Y Tran Bui.
Hey, everyone.
How's it going, guys?
Good. How are you?
Good. We had that crazy emergency podcast yesterday while Ben was traveling. When we started this podcast, this daily podcast, that's something that I really was looking forward to, is if late breaking news hit that we could, you know, jump on and, you know, just have a first reaction and give some insight into the breaking news in a way that we can't and just text. And it ended up being, by far, in less than 24 hours, our most downloaded podcast episode. So thank you for listening, and I hope you stick with us. I did want to give an update. I've talked to a bunch of people since then, and it seems like the story is legit. The story is that where Colin Trevorrow wanted to take this final film in this post-trilogy, he wanted to take it in a direction that Kathleen Kennedy and Lucasfilm and Disney were not on board with. And it seems like, you know, bringing in another writer to hopefully, because, you know, his writer is, you know, his confidant, Derek Connolly. So they brought in another writer to hopefully get to a middle ground. And that middle ground was was not turning the dial. So, Colin Trevorrow and Lucasfilm both agreed to part ways. And that's all we know right now. But you can listen to our whole podcast, which we recorded and released yesterday. And we have a lot of reactions, information. Ben, do you have any reaction to that news?
My God, that was so crazy. I would reiterate a lot of the points that you guys said. I listened to your podcast and it's unfortunate. I feel like Trevorrow is one of those guys who has a lot of talent and a lot of people hated Jurassic World, but I almost look at that movie as like his atonement for getting the job of Jurassic World, for jumping from Safety Not Guaranteed to such a blockbuster film, because that movie is actually about it has ideas in it, and the ideas are about the audience asking for bigger and more and what happens when we give that to them. And I feel like he is one of those guys who is Yeah, you guys mentioned it before. He's become like the go-to example of white privilege in Hollywood, and I think that's a little bit unfair.
I think it was partially because of those comments he made about female directors and blockbusters, but I do think he's unfairly judged. I want to say this. You know, when Book of Henry came out, a lot of people online were like, you know, fire Colin, fire. I mean, it's gross. Like the reaction, even like the, you know, people celebrating that he's, you know, been left this project. It just seems like a gross reaction from fans to think like, you know, this guy worked over a year on this film, trying to, you know, make the best Star Wars film that he could make, and we're, you know, you're celebrating, you know, this guy's failure. It's I don't know. Maybe it's that I have a lot of friends who are filmmakers and I see how hard they work, but it just seems gross to me.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's a tough situation, and we'll talk a little bit more about it when we get into the Kathleen Kennedy conversation in the mailbag later on. But
what about you, HD?
Well, I was one of those who wasn't a huge fan of Colin Trevorrow. I did not like Jurassic World, not for the nostalgia baiting like a lot of people criticize it for, but for its treatment of all the characters, not just the female characters. They were all very flat and archetypal, except for perhaps the dinosaurs. So I was not a huge fan of Jurassic World, and so I was very hesitant when I knew, like, when the news of him stepping onto Star Wars was revealed. So I was willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. I did think he got kind of an unfair rap for Book of Henry, which, you know, seemed like a passion project for him. So I did feel kind of bad that people were just like raking him over the coals for this movie that he was obviously very passionate about. And that is tough. But I got to say that, yeah, he has said some pretty bad statements about female directors, which are kind of coming from his own bubble of privilege. So I think it's a matter of just like education versus him being, you know, outrightly ignorant. But it's a weird situation. I am one of those people who are kind of glad that Trevorrow is off, because even though he is obviously very passionate about this project, it just may just not have fit in the first place.
And another reason I think he gets a lot of flack for his treatment of women, he did a 2002 short film I'm not sure if either of you have seen, called Home Base, which revolves around a guy who is dumped by his girlfriend, and he attempts to get revenge on his girlfriend by pursuing a sexual relationship with his mother, with the girlfriend's mother. So yes, cringe. You can watch that on YouTube. I'll link it in the show notes. But I personally, I mean, no, I'm not going to stick up for that short film. But I liked Jurassic World a lot, and I was looking forward to seeing what Colin was going to do with Star Wars, but that will never happen. But yes, so let's move into the water cooler. Last night, I finally got to see It. I think we talked last week or 2 weeks ago with you, Ben, because you had seen the movie at a junket screening. Mm-hmm. And boy, this movie it just checks all the boxes on, you know, it's coming of age, set in the 80s. You know, it just, I don't know, it just appeals to every single aspect of what I love about movies. The visuals. I mean, sure, it is a little long. It feels a little long. Some of the stuff is familiar, especially if you've read the book or seen the miniseries. It feels like it's playing with the, you know, coming of age tropes. And I'm kind of tired of movies with monsters or aliens being forced to make a human character a human villain of some kind. You know what? Let's just have Freddy. We don't need the human villain. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. But, you know, I'm not going to go into spoilers or anything. But, yeah, I really liked it. After getting out of the movie, I want to see chapter two. You know,
for sure.
It's like, I wish that something like this was made back to back, you know, so that I can know I could see that in a year, but likely it's probably going to be 2 years, right? So
so let me ask you this, Peter. What did you think about Bill Skarsgård's performance as Pennywise the clown?
You know, I wasn't creeped out by him. My girlfriend Kitra was my arm still hurts from from her grabbing it. She was freaked out more than I. I don't think I was scared by the movie in any way. I think if I was younger, I would have been scared. Definitely his voice, which I'm not. Has the voice been in any of the trailers?
A little bit, very briefly.
Yeah, it's kind of like this low pitched voice. I'm not sure if I like that choice for that character, but the movie definitely does some stuff. As an R-rated movie with kids in danger, it does some gutsy stuff that I don't think I've seen on the big screen in many years. And that was kind of exciting for me, because I'm excited to see a story with, you know, young children that is not, you know, PG or PG-13.
Yeah, and it's funny that you should mention that he didn't really scare you that much, because that was one of my big feelings walking out of the movie. And it was, I think for me, it was because I had just read the book for the first time. So I knew a lot of the moments, a lot of the big scares that were coming, because it does such a good job adapting the book. But and like I liked the sections of the movie that sort of added a different layer or a little extra step to it that I didn't see coming as a book reader. So yeah, it's interesting to hear you say that it didn't really scare you that much, because I wasn't as scared as I wanted to be. I still love the movie. I wasn't quite as scared as I wanted it to be, or as I wanted to be, but I was wondering if that was just because the story itself was so fresh in my mind. But it seems like, and you haven't read the book, right? Or not
recently? No, I haven't read the book. I've seen the miniseries years ago, and I remember being scared of that as a kid, but
yeah,
I'm sure if
so
I watched it now.
Yeah, it's interesting that you sort of feel the same way without having just read the book. So.
But I definitely connected with the coming-of-age story, I think, the most. And
yeah, absolutely.
I'm interested to see where this goes as them as adults in Chapter 2. Mm-hmm. That is exciting for me. You've been gone in Boston. What have you been up to?
Yeah, I visited Boston for the first time with my wife and my parents. They're from Florida, and we're obviously in LA, and we just picked a big city that we had never really been to before, and did all the sort of touristy stuff. We were only there for a couple days, few days, and
you did the duck tours.
Yeah, did the duck tour. That was really awesome. It's like they put you in these vehicles that are on land, and then they're like amphibious also. They just like it's like an outfitted World War II boat or something like that, and you can drive around with this, you know, throughout the city with the tour guide sort of pointing out spots to you along the way, and then you actually ride down into the Charles River, and it turns into a boat, basically like some sort of James Bond thing, and then you ride around on the river and get like a cool view of the city and stuff from the middle of the river. So that was pretty awesome. And yeah, like the Freedom Trail, which was like a big I think it's like a 2 mile long trail where it has all these historical monuments and stuff, like spots set up for like, oh, this was the church where Paul Revere did like the one if by land, two if by sea thing with the lanterns and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So like,
did you
love
the clam chowder?
No, I'm not a big clam chowder fan, but
did you go to Faneuil Hall at least?
We walked through there a little bit. I think it's Quincy Market, which is right next to that. They have like tons of food, and yeah, it's sort of like Grand Central Market in downtown LA. And yeah, we went there a couple times to eat, and the food was always really good. I was somebody who was never really super interested in American history, just because it was so dry in, you know, when I was growing up in elementary school, when they teach you about all this stuff. It was really cool. It sort of, opened my eyes to the fact that these are like real people. These aren't just like names in a history book. I know that probably sounds stupid, but like standing on the spot of, you know, like the Boston Massacre, like all these places where the revolution began, it was a really cool experience to be there and sort of you know, walk where these people walked. And it makes me want to go back and like dive into that period of history and like really learn about it in a way that just a textbook couldn't teach me about.
Yeah, I lived in a town outside of Boston growing up. So as a kid, we would, you know, regularly take school trips to Boston and visit those kind of locations. I love the architecture. I love, you know, the cobblestone streets and these small, like, historic buildings surrounded by skyscrapers. And I also
the alleys.
Yeah. And I used to, for a summer, I worked at the New England Aquarium, which is shortly by where the area you're talking about. And every day I'd run to Quincy Market and grab something from one of the booths and eat, nice. And then bring it back and watch the penguins and the penguin exhibit. But yes, so I love Boston, and you and I being in California, you're lucky to see, you know, an 80-year-old building.
Right.
Yeah. HD, what have you been up to?
So I have been a bit fixated on the story surrounding My Immortal, which is an infamous Harry Potter fan fiction that was published in 2006 and 2007. So the reason that it's starting to come up again is that there's been a long and arduous search for who the mysterious author behind this fan fiction is. So the reason why this is a huge internet mystery is because this fan fiction is notoriously bad. But it also spanned 44 chapters and almost 23,000 words. So it was a wow. Terrible fan fiction, but they kept at it. And that's what's the most remarkable. So there are lines like, it's about this this character who is a new character named Ebony Raven Dementia Way. And she's in a she's a vampire who's in a relationship with Draco Malfoy, and his ex-boyfriend is Harry Potter, except he's named Vampire Potter. So it's all kind of ridiculous. My Immortal is the title of an Evanescence song, and they make lots of references to all those emo punk bands from the early 2000s, like My Chemical Romance. I think like Gerard Way is her idol or something. So it's written so badly, but in a way that's incredibly amusing and almost...
And by the way,
artistic?
you say 23,000 words. That
23,000 words.
That is exactly one third the size of the first Harry Potter book.
Yes,
That's a lot.
It is a novel. It is a novel of badly written garbage, but it's a very amusing garbage. Here, I'll read some sentences. So, one of them is, "I may be a Hogwarts student," Hagrid paused angrily, "but I am also a Satanist." another one is, "Konnichiwa, everybody, come in," said Professor Sinister in Japanese. another one is, "Hi, vampire," I said flirtily as I started to sob. So it's
a
just
flirty
like,
sob. I love that move.
Flirty sob. Because, you know, she's emo, so she has to, you know, represent. It's just incredibly fascinating how bad it is. So there are all these theories surrounding it, whether it was a troll fanfic, whether someone just wrote this, you know, 44 chapter novel in complete satire, essentially. But it feels like it's from the musings of some, you know, very from a very imaginative teenage girl. Recently it resurfaced again because the fanfiction .net account on which it was originally published was updated, the biography, and it basically came to say, "Hi, I am not Lani Sarem, who is the author of this YA book called Handbook for Mortals, which recently stirred up some controversy in the YA novel Twitter circles because it was allegedly buying New York Times bestsellers, buying the spot on the New York Times bestseller list by
the publisher buying a lot of books.
Yeah, by buying a lot of books in the bookstores that would report to the bestsellers list. So that was discovered, and a lot of people were making parallels to My Immortal because the language was very similar and very bad. So the author apparently went back on fanfiction.com to state that she was not Lani Sarem because that was such a gross accusation. But after that, a publisher said that this is not the author, but someone else who is writing a memoir about her writing My Immortal. So it got this woman who was writing the memoir got tracked down to her Tumblr to a novelist named Rose Christo, who came out on her Tumblr saying that, yes, she wrote My Immortal. And she didn't answer whether it was a troll fic or not, but she's currently writing Under the Same Stars, which is a memoir about her, allegedly. And it's fascinating. I'm not sure if this is the same person. It might just be one of the many people who came out to claim that they were responsible for the amazing work of art that is My Immortal. But it seems genuine, apparently.
What a labyrinth. Jeez.
Yeah, yeah. It is. It's like, it's one of those early internet conspiracies / mysteries that just like is very fascinating for people who grew up in this sort of like digital time and who grew up reading fan fiction, a lot of bad and good fan fiction. So
it's weird that it's finally coming out now who she is after all these years. We'll have the link to My Immortal in the show notes.
Yes, please do.
But we're almost 20 minutes into the show, so let's get right into the news, guys. Live action Aladdin movie has cast its token white guy. HT, you wrote this up for the site. I feel like almost every other day on the site and on the podcast, we're talking about some kind of problematic casting in Hollywood. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, it's almost like it's a systemic problem. The Hollywood Reporter broke the news that Billy Magnuson, who is known for recently appearing in Ingrid Goes West and also appearing in Into the Woods as the other prince, has been cast in Aladdin as Prince Anders from Scanland, which is a municipality in Norway. So it is a real country, or real municipality, at least. So he is an original character who was not in the original animated movie from 1992. He's been created entirely for this new film directed by Guy Ritchie. So he will reportedly be one of the suitors for Princess Jasmine, who she rejects constantly as a sort of refusal to abide by her father, the Sultan's orders, and because, you know, she's a rebel. So there's not much more information about what role he will play and how big of a role it will be, but it is a little bit concerning because he will be the first white actor who has been cast in this movie. So far we've had only people of color be cast. We've had the lead actors cast as Egyptian-Canadian actor Mina Masood, half Indian, half British actress Naomi Scott. Will Smith was cast as the CGI genie, and then actress Nasim Pedrad, who is from Saturday Night Live, is playing a handmaid. Numana Carr is henchman, and Marwan Kanzari is Jafar.
Let me play the idiot devil's advocate here. You have this entire diverse cast. Why can't there be one white guy in this adaptation?
Because there's no need for it. There's just no storyline or narrative that calls for a white guy to be in Aladdin, which is set firmly in the Middle East, strictly the Arabian Peninsula. It is of the utmost importance to people who are fans of the film and fans of the story that it have a diverse cast, because like we were talking about yesterday, it's about representation. It's about seeing yourself on screen. And because there are so few roles and prominent roles for people of color and people specifically of Middle Eastern and South Asian descent who aren't, you know, terrorists or something of the sort, then it feels like it's diluting how powerful a movie this could be. And it also goes into the whole shoehorning a white actor in order to sell a movie in Hollywood.
Which also seems weird is this guy's not even a big star, so it's not like you're shoehorning Matt Damon or shoehorning Tom Cruise into the movie to sell tickets. You're exactly shoehorning a white actor into the movie
just to have a white face.
Yeah. So
yeah, that's why it just seems completely needless. I don't really understand this thinking other than just to, like, I don't know, have white representation in it, which isn't a very strong argument. Have not been very happy with this news.
You have a whole article on Slash Film that is a feature on the site, so I would recommend everybody go to that and read that. Let's move on in the news. An authorized Dracula prequel is coming. That bit of news does not excite me, but it's coming from the director of It. That does excite me. Ben, you're at the article for the site. What do we know?
Yeah, so Paramount has acquired the screen rights to a project called Dracul, which is a a prequel novel that's co-written by Bram Stoker's great grandnephew and a horror author named J.D. Barker. The story is set in 1868, where a 21-year-old Bram Stoker meets up with an ungodly evil that he traps in an ancient tower, all the while scribbling the events that led him there. So this is a book that Paramount is turning into a movie. It's unclear who is going to be writing that movie, but Andy Muschietti, who's directing the new It movie, is attached to direct the project. We know he's also attached to direct a live-action adaptation of Robotech, so it's probably going to be a little while before this one hits theaters. We saw the origin of Dracula in 2014's Dracula Untold. That didn't exactly pan out very well. We know that Universal has their whole Dark Universe, cinematic universe thing that they've got set up, and I don't think they've officially cast a new Dracula yet, but that character features prominently in the company's announcement video that they released when they said, hey, we're going by the name Dark Universe now. They showed a bunch of clips from the old horror movies like The Wolfman, Invisible Man, all that stuff, and Dracula was featured pretty heavily in there. Years ago, they were talking about, oh yeah, Dracula Untold is actually the first movie in this whole thing, but that seems like the sort of redheaded stepchild of the Dark Universe so far, where they could very easily, if they wanted to, just forget that that whole thing ever happened. So it's unclear whether they're going to cast Luke Evans again, you know, bring him back to play Dracula. He seems like kind of a smaller actor, you know, going up against people like Tom Cruise and, you know, Russell Crowe, you know, like big heavy hitter A-list guys. So I'm not quite sure if Luke Evans can sort of hang in that company. But yeah, this is supposed to be a separate project, and Paramount definitely needs a hit. So I don't know if this is going to be a new franchise for them or what.
And you said the author plays a role in the story. So this is kind of like Shakespeare in Love or... I mean, this past week we had a trailer for a movie I didn't even know existed called The Man Who Invented Christmas, which is the story of Charles Dickens writing A Christmas Carol. I'm not sure if we need... I guess Hollywood really has run out of ideas, because now they're tackling not remakes of these classic stories, but the origin stories of these classic stories.
And this one, you know, it sounds like it has like a little bit of a spin to it, where like the story of Dracula was inspired by these quote unquote real supernatural events that this version of Bram Stoker experiences in this movie. So it's like a little bit different than just like a purely sort of uncinematic telling of just a guy writing a book. But still, yeah, I'm sort of with you, Peter. I feel like this, I don't need to see this story, but I am a little bit intrigued that Andy Muschietti is involved, so we'll see.
Yeah. Moving on, Justice League is apparently still undergoing reshoots, and they're doubling down on Wonder Woman. We previously told you that they had added a dream sequence with, a flashback sequence with Robin Wright's character from Wonder Woman. HT, you wrote the story for the site. What do we know?
So they're going under a record crunch time for Justice League, which comes out in theaters in 2 months. So we have a new news of reshoots coming from Swedish kickboxer / MMA fighter Madeline Valbaner. So she played one of the Amazons in Wonder Woman, and she posted on her Instagram that she will be reuniting with her fellow Amazon warriors to film a new scene in Italy, which is where they shot the scenes for Themyscira in Wonder Woman. And she is going in less than 3 weeks and she also tagged Antiope, which is Robin Wright's character. So through process of elimination, it can only be Justice League that she is going back to shoot, because Wonder Woman is now on Blu-ray and DVD, and Wonder Woman 2 is not yet in production after the long negotiations that Patty Jenkins went through for her pay. So less than 3 weeks is narrowing down on about a month to go before Justice League comes out, by the time they finish shooting these hopefully last shots for the reshoots. So it's going to be going down to crunch time.
This sounds like it might be the scene that I was speaking about in an earlier podcast, where Robin Wright's character basically, it's used to explain who Steppenwolf is, and she basically explains it in a flashback to Diana, I think.
Right.
So I think
so they're that, like, Yeah, so they're going to be introducing Steppenwolf through the flashback because his boom tube will reportedly take him to Themyscira and result, I think, in some big battle scene led by Antiope and the Amazons against Steppenwolf.
That makes sense. Okay, the most surprising bit in today's news are that there are new bidders for the James Bond film rights. We just assumed it was going to be Sony, but joining the mix are Amazon and Apple. Ben, you wrote it for the site. What do we know here?
Yeah, so MGM and Eon Productions control the rights to the James Bond franchise, but they don't actually distribute the movies. Previously, for the past like 10 plus years, Sony has been the distributor, but recently their contract ran out. So Sony and Warner Brothers and Universal and Fox and Annapurna Films, Annapurna Pictures of all places, have been sort of vying for the rights to distribute the new Bond movies, and now Apple and Amazon are getting into the mix. The Hollywood Reporter says that Warner Brothers is currently the front runner to potentially land the rights to distribute the films, but Apple and Amazon are both willing to spend in the same ballpark as Warner Brothers, if not much more. That theoretically could be a pretty big deal if it happens, because there is the potential, considering these companies are both sort of primarily digital. There's the thought that maybe they could be looking to purchase the entire rights to the James Bond property outright instead of just the right to distribute. And if that is the case, then maybe they could, expand the character out into a James Bond TV show, for example, or any number of ways to sort of franchise out this already existing film franchise. So yeah, that would definitely throw a huge wrench into the way that blockbuster filmmaking works in Hollywood right now. Apparently, Warner Brothers considers Apple a legitimate threat because the Hollywood Reporter says that Warner Brothers is now pushing MGM hard to close a deal quickly, presumably before Apple can sort of get in there and gain enough leverage to negotiate the deal away from Warner Brothers. So, yeah, this is just sort of an out of nowhere announcement, and it has some interesting implications for the future of the landscape as we know it.
This seems so weird because, I mean, Amazon makes sense, but Apple does not. I know they're doing some original shows for Apple Music. They're doing that Carpool Karaoke and that app show. I forget what it's called, something of the app. I don't know. I just don't see Apple building their own Netflix. Amazon's obviously trying to compete in that area. I feel like if Apple wants to do anything, they should just buy Netflix or buy Disney. And I think I was saying this earlier in the Slash Film or Slash Film staff private chat, but Apple is almost worth $1 trillion. So they have in cash $246 billion.
That's insane.
Disney's only worth 175. Netflix is supposedly only worth like 70. They could buy Netflix and Disney and not be in debt. I mean, that
That's
probably,
amazing.
yeah, but like, why? It just seems so ridiculous for Apple to buy a film property or franchise. It seems like they should be going bigger. I don't know. At
Yeah,
least that's
I
my.
tend to agree, and I wonder if the thing that I don't want to happen is for a deal like that to go through, and then we get a James Bond TV show, for example, but you can only watch it, on an Apple an Apple exclusive thing like Apple Music or something like that, where you have to like pay another subscription fee to watch it. I fear that that's the way that things are going, and I would be so upset if that happened.
Peter, are you advocating for Apple to try to accomplish world domination?
I love Apple. I am an
Oh,
Apple.
yes.
I am an Apple stockholder.
Oh, that's why.
And you know what?
Okay.
Part of the Disney board and part of the Apple board has some crossover with Disney. So I don't know. I just see that as the perfect marriage. I feel like that's going to happen one day. It seems like Apple, Apple always uses Disney products in their like demos, and you know, they use Pixar on like their iPad commercial or whatnot. It just seems like the perfect marriage. And if they want to get into, Apple definitely wants to get into the space that Amazon and Netflix are going into, of having, you know, a streaming service and owning content. Mm-hmm. And it seems like the best way to do that is to buy the content. And Disney is the content. You know, Disney has said that they're going to start a streaming service. I mean, it seems like a no-brainer to me, but what do I know?
Yeah.
We are 34 minutes into the show, so we should get into the mailbag, guys. Jake from Massachusetts asks, is Kathleen Kennedy to blame for all the Star Wars problems? I'll start this out. I think that's an unfair question. Kathleen Kennedy has, we've said this before in the podcast, it has a long track record of producing amazing films with amazing directors, and I think she's used to working with these top-level talent that doesn't need the hand-holding that some of these newcomers do. And I think the plan to hire these hot upcoming directors for Star Wars was maybe misguided. But I think there's some lessons to be learned here, especially with the Lord and Miller Han Solo thing. And that is, you know, if you fix the problems before you start shooting, you save yourself hundreds of millions of dollars. So I think her, you know, switching gears before we start shooting episode 9, I think that's a smart move by her. I don't know if Kathleen Kennedy is the person to run Lucasfilm in the long run. I have faith in her. I you know, she's made so many good decisions, and even with the people that she's hired, even though maybe it hasn't worked out in the end, it seemed like good decisions on paper. If she were ever to leave Lucasfilm, I would love to see Kevin Feige, the head of Marvel, who loves Star Wars and has, you know, he developed the model of cinematic universes and, you know, hiring these hot young directors to work in a collaborative corporate entity. I think Kevin Feige, and I bet you if you ask Kevin Feige, I mean, he's been doing the Marvel thing for so long since, you know, X-Men came out. I would bet he's looking for, you know, an exciting change in his career. I would love to see Kevin Feige run Lucasfilm and Marvel, Lucasfilm and Star Wars. But I don't think Kathleen Kennedy's to blame. I think this could have happened to anybody of her stature. What do you think, HD?
I'm going to get on my soapbox here for a second and say that as soon as we have a woman like Kathleen Kennedy in power behind the scenes, people start singling her out as the cause for all the mess that's going on at Lucasfilm and at Disney. And I don't think that is the single cause. Yeah. I think, you know,
and I also realize it's problematic replacing her with Kevin, a white male.
But, no, I wasn't talking about that.
Okay.
But, I do think, like you said, Kathleen Kennedy is part of the old guard of Hollywood, and that's the way that she works and that she knows how to work. And Lucasfilm and Disney were trying out the sort of the Marvel strategy of plucking these indie directors out of obscurity after they had one successful hit or one or two successful hits, and putting them at the helm of really big blockbusters that they haven't had experience making before. And sometimes it turns out well, and sometimes it doesn't turn out well. You have, for example, Fantastic Four by Josh Trank, which tanked. Josh Tranked. But you have success stories like Trevorrow with Jurassic World, even though I have my personal thoughts about that. But, you know, it's a hit or miss strategy. And I think that Kathleen Kennedy is so set in her ways of working that she's not willing to take as many chances, because Star Wars is a really influential and big property, and they can't really afford to have so many misses as before. And I do think that she also feels pressure as a woman to not have as many failures at the box office or critically.
For sure. And it should be mentioned that Marvel wasn't without their failures early on. You know, they had a lot of rough going in those early Marvel Cinematic Universe films. So, I mean, it takes some getting going to get there. Ben, what are your thoughts?
So the question is Kathleen Kennedy to blame for all the Star Wars problems? I think the answer is yes, but what everyone sees as problems is just being viewed from the viewpoint of a director. And I think that she's definitely responsible, but she is responsible for shaping the company and this, yes, highly influential, incredibly expensive, potentially lucrative brand that, you know, very few people have the amount of pressure on them, on their shoulders, that Kathleen Kennedy does. I think you're right, Peter, and HT. I think she has the years and the experience to do it. I would like to see her do it for years and years and years to come. I think Kevin Feige is doing his thing, and you know, I think he'll be fine. I'm not really worried about the future of Kevin Feige. I would love to see Kennedy sort of settle into a groove where it, because I feel like this is just, you know, like you're saying, Peter, the same thing with early MCU. This is just sort of a chaotic period for Lucasfilm right now. It's clear that they were sort of going after the sexier choices for directors, and that hasn't really worked out very well. I would like to think that they're going to, you know, and right now all of us are like, oh, well, they picked Ron Howard to direct Han Solo, so this basically means that they're going with nothing but safe choices from here on out. I would like to think that they're going to be able to sort of strike a balance and, you know, go with more people like in the realm of Rian Johnson and maybe like an Ava DuVernay, you know, people who have proven track records on their own, but who are able to work with big corporations and actually thrive in a producer-driven environment. So it's just, it's a super challenging thing to, you know, we as a film blogging community tend to fetishize directors and creatives. And a lot of times we don't give people like Kennedy the credit that I think she deserves for being able to, you know, wrangle all of this stuff. So yeah, it's easy on the outside to say like, oh, it's, you know, Kennedy's at the top, so all of this is her fault, quote unquote. But I think she has a tremendous responsibility to the Disney shareholders, you know, all of this kind of stuff. And she wants to make good movies. And I think The Force Awakens is a great movie. So I think that it can be done.
I agree.
So I'm just hoping that, that, you know, nobody, that Bob Iger doesn't fire her because of all this kind of stuff. I would love to see her sort of shake this off and move on and continue to triumph moving forward.
Yeah, I definitely don't think she's going to get fired. I think if anything, she would step down. But I don't see that happening either. And I just want to say that even though we're saying Star Wars problems, you know, The Force Awakens was one of the top films of all times at the box office. And the merchandising sales is, you know, a juggernaut. Rogue One was widely reviewed as a success, the box office amazing. So far the first two releases from the system, even though there have been some you know, costly reshoots and whatnot that, you know, probably hurt the bottom line, have not been failures in any sense of the word. And when you compare that to Marvel, there were some failures early on. You know, look at Iron Man 2. I think she has some time left to prove herself, and I think she is going to prove herself. But
I agree. I think we tend to prejudge these things as we report constantly on these corporate goings on, and we don't really we kind of lose track of, you know, the final product, which are the movies that come out. And, you know, it will be a couple of years before we see any of these movies except for The Last Jedi. And I think that I agree completely with Ben about the creatives versus the corporates sort of debate that goes on. I think, like, you know, the corporates do their job well, and they have had their success for a reason. You know, they count their losses and they play things close to the chest for good reasons, because they have a respect for these stories.
For sure. Okay. Anyways, if you want to submit your question to the mailbag, send them to peter@slashfilm.com. Please mention your name and general geographic location in case we mention the question on the air like we did with Jake from Massachusetts. Again, that's peter@slashfilm.com. You can find more of my work at slashfilm on Twitter. You can find Ben at Ben Pears on Twitter. You can find HT at HTran Bowie on Twitter and the Millennial Falcon podcast on iTunes. You can find more on all these stories on slashfilm.com. You can subscribe to Slash Film Daily, which is published every weekday on iTunes, Google Play, Overcast, all the popular podcast apps. Just search Slash Film Daily. If you are enjoying this, please head over to iTunes or Google Play Store. Leave us a review. Rate us. That helps us out quite a bit. It gives us a boost up in the rankings, and it helps more people find this. Tweet, Facebook, share the word, and we will see you tomorrow.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Welcome to Prime Video's Culture-Rated Collection. This is the place where Black is the main character, where we don't jump through hoops just to hear our voice and can fall in love with illuminating documentaries like Giannis, The Marvelous Journey.
I'm just a hard worker that's trying to survive.
Enjoy the animated series, The Second Best Hospital in the Galaxy.
All doctors report immediately!
Where we dive into something new like the latest season of Them, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction.
Welcome home, baby!
Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love.
I want my music to unify people.
And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop.
This is the cleanest police car I've ever been in my life.
And BMF.
You're about to take over the whole nation.
Explore Prime Video's Culture-Rated Collection and enjoy old school greats and new school hits. Prime Video. Find your happy place. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/AmazonPrime for details.